Romance of the Three Kingdoms, Chapter 96.
While Kangming is dealing with absolute chaos, the Wei Emperor Cao Rui, he actually makes a surprisingly calm decision, a long-term strategic one.
Yeah, remarkably measured. And it's based on advice from Minister Sun Ze. Crucially, Sima Yi immediately backs him up.
Ah, Sima Yi. Okay, so that tells you this is solid advice, politically unified too.
Right. Sun Ze basically lays it out. Forget a full-scale invasion of Shu right now. It's madness.
Madness. But Shu's reeling, aren't they? Seems like the perfect time to strike.
Geographically, it's a nightmare. Sun Ze points this out. He reminds the court, the Nansheng region. Historically, it was called a true celestial prison.
A celestial prison, okay.
And he mentions the Zhangji Valley Road specifically. Calls it a 500-li stone cave. Basically saying, you don't send armies there easily. The terrain itself is Shu's best defense.
So pouring troops and resources into that kind of landscape,
yeah,
it's just asking for trouble, a logistical quagmire.
Exactly. And there's another huge strategic risk. Sun Ze warns, if Wei commits all its main forces to invade Shu in the west,
their other rival, Wu, is going to jump on the opportunity in the east.
Decisely. They'd be exposed on two fronts. Major gamble.
Okay, I see. But just sitting back and defending, mm-hmm. isn't that a bit passive? You're kind of letting the enemy dictate things.
It's what you might call calculated patience. The plan isn't about aggression. It's about consolidation. Strengthen their own defenses, let the Wei heartland recover and grow stronger.
And just wait.
And wait for Shu and Wu to, as he puts it, naturally destroy themselves. The idea is their internal struggles, the sheer difficulty of maintaining those empires, will do Wei's work for them eventually.
Safer than a massive, risky invasion.
Much safer, in their view.
Yeah.
So Cao Rui agrees, hold the key choke points, secure the borders, and head back to Luoyang. Let time work for them. That's the Wei calculation.
Yeah.
Prudent defense. Long-term game.
Okay, cold, rational. Now, let's shift. Let's go back to Shu, where it's anything but cold and rational. Kanming's back in Hanzhong, ordering generals out to help the stragglers. The anxiety must have been intense.
Crushing, you'd imagine. But then, even before the rescue parties can leave, there's news. A report comes in.
Good news.
Astonishingly good news, under the circumstances. Zhao Yun and Ding Ji have returned. Successfully. And this is where we pivot, you know. From cold strategy to this moment of pure moral virtue, right in the middle of this disaster.
The details are amazing, aren't they? The report says they returned without losing a single man or horse.
Yeah. And maybe even more telling for discipline. No supplies or baggage lost either. Think about that. Other units are falling apart, total chaos, and these guys execute a perfect disciplined retreat.
Kangming must have been thrilled. A small victory in a sea of defeat.
Oh, absolutely delighted. He personally goes out to greet them. But Zhao Yun, he immediately gets off his horse, prostrates himself, says he's a general of a defeated army. They have no merit, nothing to claim.
Even though they succeeded.
Even though he specifically succeeded. Deng Yi explains it was Zhao Yun himself, single-handedly covering the rear, who scared off the enemy pursuit and kept everything intact.
Yeah.
Kangming's blown away. Offers a huge reward on the spot.
How?
50 jin of gold.
Yeah.
10,000 pi of silk. I mean, that's an astronomical amount. Enough to supply a small army for months. It's Kangming saying, you saved our honor. You saved vital resources.
But Zhao Yun turns it down. This is the virtue nugget you mentioned.
Exactly. He refuses. Says the whole army shares the guilt of defeat. Accepting a reward now, it would make Kangming's reward and punishment unclear, especially when others failed so badly.
So what does he suggest?
He asks for the gold and silk to be put in the public treasury, stored away, maybe distributed to all the troops later that winter.
Wow, that's quite a statement.
It's incredible moral leadership, isn't it?
Yeah.
Everyone else is probably thinking about how to avoid blame, and Zhao Yun sets this incredibly high standard. It tells the troops, judgment will be fair, consistent, even for heroes.
And Kangming praises him for it.
Highly. Recalls how the late Emperor Liu Bei always praised Zhao Yun's virtue. It really underscores Zhao Yun's character.
And it really sets the stage, doesn't it? For the difficult part, the accountability for those who did fail. If the successful guy refuses a reward out of principle, what happens to the ones responsible for the loss?
Precisely. It establishes a moral benchmark. So now the other generals show up. Ma Su, Wang Ping, Wei Yan, Gao Xiang. The moment of truth arrives. And Kangming starts with Wang Ping.
He asks Wang Ping why he didn't, you know, advise Ma Su better. Straight to the point.
Wang Ping's defense immediately points the finger. He says he told Ma Su repeatedly, build an earth fort on the main road. That was the tactically sound thing to do.
But Ma Su
angrily dismisses him. Arrogance, disobedience. Wang Ping basically says, I tried, he wouldn't listen.
So Wang Ping made his own call.
He did something smart. He followed the spirit of military caution, even if Ma Su ignored the specifics. He set up his own camp, 10 little away, down from the mountain, with his 5,000 men.
Which saved them when Ma Su's mountain position collapsed.
Exactly. He survived. Then he describes trying to help Wei Yan and Guo Xiang, realizing it was hopeless, and making the tough call to fall back and defend the crucial Yangping Pass. The whole front was collapsing.
So Wang Ping's testimony paints a clear picture. Ma Su's direct disobedience, his arrogance, it was the fatal flaw.
Absolutely. The stage is now set, the evidence is clear, and then Ma Su enters.
Self-bound, already accepting guilt.
Self-bound, kneeling before Kongbing. You just feel the weight of this moment. Kongbing is facing probably the most painful duty of his career.
He confronts Ma Su directly, reminds him, you knew battle tactics. You knew Jiting was the foundation, the Zhenben, the root.
And then he invokes the law. He has to. If the military laws are not made clear and just, how can we subdue the multitude? It's that moment, law over personal feelings. He's establishing the principle.
Ma Su makes a last-ditch plea, though, right? Some historical analogy.
Yeah, desperate, clever plea. He brings up the ancient emperor Shun. Shun executed a guy named Gun for failure, but then he wisely employed Gun's son, the capable Yu, who achieved great things.
Kongbing.
Tearfully, the text says. He reaffirms their personal bond, calls Ma Su brother, promises, your son is my son. It's this profound gesture of personal care.
But the law.
But the law must stand. For the discipline, for the morale of the entire army after such a disaster, he orders the execution, weeping.
It's brutal. But the details afterwards are strange, almost. What Kongbing does next?
Oh, this is where it gets really interesting, psychologically and politically. Ma Su is executed, age 39. But then Kongbing orders something unusual.
What's that?
He orders Ma Su's head to be sewn back onto the body.
What? Why?
It's a powerful symbolic act, restoring the man's wholeness, even in death, showing profound respect despite the execution. Then he arranges a proper burial, personally writes a funeral oration.
And takes care of the family.
Fully subsidizes them. Grain every month. It's this incredible paradox. He upholds the harshest military law to maintain order.
But immediately follows with extreme personal affection and grief, honoring the man he just condemned.
Exactly. Walking that political tightrope. Preserve the law. Honor the individual. It's quite something.
And he reflects on it afterwards, doesn't he? On his own mistake.
He does. He remembers Liu Bei's warning years earlier. The late emperor had apparently said Ma Su's words exceeded his actual ability, that he shouldn't be given high command.
Ouch. Kongbing realizes Liu Bei was right.
And crucially, he realizes his own error wasn't just about tactics on the day. It was about his judgment of character in appointing Ma Su in the first place.
That self-awareness, that introspection, realizing the responsibility starts and ends with him. That leads us right into the next part, doesn't it? Leadership through self-correction.
Radical self-correction, really. Mm. Punishing the subordinate isn't enough. The leader, the system itself, needs fixing from the top down.
So what does he do?
He immediately writes a formal memorial, a Baiyawan, to the latter emperor, and he asks for self-punishment.
He owns the failure completely.
Absolutely. Takes responsibility, not just for Jiting Ma Su's failure, but also for another loss at Jigu, which he calls his own negligence.
And he pinpoints his own flaws.
Yes. Systemic flaws. Mm-hmm. His inability to properly train and clarify the laws, he says. And maybe most importantly, his failure to truly know men. His poor judgment of character.
And he asks for demotion.
Demotion by 3 full ranks. A significant public admission of failure.
How does the court react to that? Demoting the chancellor seems risky.
Well, it's handled very strategically. An official named Fei Yi argues, yes, upholding the law is vital even for the chancellor. It reinforces governance.
But the emperor needs Kongbing.
Exactly. The latter emperor knows he can't just sideline his most capable minister and commander. So they reach this clever political compromise. Kongbing is formally demoted. His title changes to General of the Right. Public accountability is served, but he's still permitted to act as chancellor, and crucially, he retains supreme command of the armies.
So it's a symbolic sacrifice, basically. It upholds the principle of accountability without actually crippling the state's leadership. Very smart.
Very pragmatic. But Kongbing himself, he's not done with the self-criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Not by a long shot.
What happens next?
Fei Yi visits him later, tries to offer some comfort, you know, points out some minor successes. They did capture 4 counties initially, even if they lost them, and they captured that enemy general, Jiang Wei. trying to find a silver lining.
And Kong Ming's reaction?
He shuts it down, harshly. Says gaining land and then immediately losing it. That's exactly the same as never having gained it at all.
No consolation prizes?
None. And capturing one enemy general, Jian Wei. That didn't hurt Wei's overall strength one bit. He refuses to be comforted by small tactical gains when the strategic failure was so massive.
That really tells you about his mindset after this defeat, doesn't it? Results are all that matter.
Totally. Results, not effort. And the final wisdom he shares with his subordinates. This is probably the biggest leadership takeaway from the whole chapter.
What does he say?
He points out that during the campaign, Xu actually had more soldiers than Wei at Jiting. More men.
Really? So it wasn't about numbers?
Not at all. Yet they failed. Therefore, he concludes, the failure wasn't troop strength. It was the commander. Ma Su, yes, but ultimately, his own failure to appoint the right commander.
Things are moving slowly, but it's deeply strategic. Zhu Jiliang, Kong Ming, he's in Hansong. And it's pretty clear he's getting ready for another big push north against Wei.
Yeah, and the sources really stress how systematic he is. He's not rushing things. He's showing compassion, you know, looking after the troops and the people. But the preparation is intense. We get these details about him training soldiers, building special gear like siege equipment and crossing rafts. And just tons of grain, tons of supplies being stockpiled. Definitely playing the long game.
And naturally, this careful buildup doesn't go unnoticed in Luoyang, the Wei capital. Emperor Cao Rui calls in Sima Yi. Now, you'd think, okay, Kong Ming's visibly preparing. Maybe we should hit him first, right? A preemptive strike.
Wow.
But Sima Yi actually advises against that.
Okay. But if the buildup was so obvious, why wait? Wasn't that risky, letting Xu get stronger?
Well, Sima Yi was thinking about logistics. And maybe the weather, too. He figures the summer heat is just too intense right then. He predicts that Xu will certainly not emerge immediately, so he's basically betting on the conditions holding them back for a bit. But the real genius isn't just guessing the timing, it's predicting how Kong Ming will attack when he finally does.
And he specifically mentions the dark crossing of Cheng Kang.
Yeah.
What was that? Why was that specific prediction so important?
It's a classic move, really, like a feint. You make a big show of preparing one route, the obvious one, but secretly you send your main force through a really tough, unexpected path, usually narrow, maybe heavily defended somewhere they wouldn't expect you. It's famously associated with Han Xin, a great general from the Han Dynasty. Sima Yi knows Kong Ming loves these kinds of surprise tactics.
So Sima Yi isn't just saying wait and see. He's saying he's going to try this specific trick, so we need to defend this specific place. It's like anticipation versus preparation, and anticipation won this round.
Exactly. Pure anticipation. And based on that, Sima Yi recommends putting General Hao Zai in charge of defending the Cheng Kang Pass. The sources paint a great picture of Hao Zai, apparently 9 feet tall, strong, great archer, very strategic mind. So Hao Zai gets the job, made general who guards the West. And it works. Good advice taken, defense prioritized, trap avoided, strategic success.
Okay, so that sets a baseline, right? Rational command, careful planning. Hold on to that thought.
Yeah.
Because now we're swinging completely the other way. Over to the Eastern Front, where, let's just say, ambition kind of steamrolls rationality.
Yeah, it's quite the contrast. While Sima Yu is being patient in the West, Cao Zhu in the East is about to learn a hard lesson about impatience. We shift focus to the Wei Wu border. Cao Zhu, he's the Wei Grand Commander there. And he gets this report, very exciting stuff, saying Zhu Fang, who's the Wu prefect of Poyang, wants to surrender, wants to defect to Wei.
And it wasn't just, hey, I want to switch sides. Zhu Fang came with a plan, didn't he? These seven matters,
yeah.
What was in them? What made them so tempting for Wei?
Oh, they were detailed. Think military gold, troop locations, supply weaknesses, specific routes to bypass Wu defenses and just roll them up quickly. It wasn't vague promises. It felt like a concrete blueprint for victory. So Cao Rui, the emperor, and even Sima Yi look at it and think, yeah, this looks solid. Wu should be destroyed. The bait is perfect because it feels actionable and promises a quick, decisive win.
But almost immediately, someone waves a huge red flag.
Yeah.
General Jia Ku steps up.
Mm.
And this is where you see that clash.
Mm-hmm.
The desire for this easy victory versus cautious, experienced advice.
Yeah, Jia Ku, he's a veteran. He basically says, hold on a minute. He points out Wu forces can be unpredictable, inconsistent, he calls them. And Zhu Fang himself, known as a clever guy, a strategist, Jia Ku argues it must be a trick, a lure to pull Wei forces into an ambush. His logic is pretty sound. Why would a smart enemy prefect just hand over the keys to the kingdom?
So there's the choice for Wei command, this amazing shiny plan promising total victory, or this inconvenient warning from a respected general saying, wait, it's probably a trap. And they went with Shiny.
They went with Shiny. They committed to this massive three-pronged invasion based entirely on Zhu Fang's intel. Cao Zhu leads the main force towards Wancheng. Jia Ku gets sent off towards Yangcheng and Dongguan. Sima Yi is tasked towards Jiangling. The whole Wei war machine cranks into motion, heading straight into the jaws of the trap.
Meanwhile, on the Wu side, they must have been rubbing their hands together. Sun Quan knows it's all a setup. He puts Lu Sun, one of his best commanders, in charge, gives him supreme authority, the white banner, and yellow axe, the works.
Right, and Lu Sun, showing good command, immediately sets up his flanking commanders, Zhu Huan and Krong Kong, ready to spring the trap.
Okay, but even on the winning side, there was a bit of internal disagreement, wasn't there? About strategy.
Yeah, a small interesting point. Zhu Huan, one of the flank commanders, actually suggested a follow-up plan. He said, okay, after we beat Cao Xiu, let's immediately block the mountain escape routes, Jianxi and Guash, with, like, felled trees and rocks. Seal them in completely.
Sounds practical. Why didn't Lu Sun go for it?
Confidence, maybe? Or just sticking to his own vision. Lu Chan just dismissed it. This is not a good strategy. I have a superior plan, he basically says. He seems to believe his main ambush will be so overwhelming, they won't need to worry about blocking escape routes. It's a little echo of the Wei situation, isn't it? Ignoring potentially useful counsel.
Interesting parallel. But okay, back to the main deception. The absolute critical moment comes when Cao Zhu actually meets Zhu Fang face to face. Even with the Seven Matters, Cao Zhu still has some doubts nagging him. He needs something more.
And Zhu Fang gives it to him in the most dramatic way possible. He understands that just talking isn't enough, so he bursts into tears, grabs a sword, makes like he's going to kill himself to prove his loyalty. Cao Zhu stops him, naturally. And then Zhu Fang does something incredibly powerful psychologically. He cuts off his own hair, he throws it on the ground, and swears allegiance to Wei.
Wow. And culturally, that was awesome. It's a massive, right? Cutting your hair wasn't like getting a trim today?
Not at all. Your body, including your hair, was seen as a gift from your parents. Cutting it was a profound taboo, an act of self-mutilation almost, like severing ties with your ancestors, usually only done in extreme mourning or as a serious punishment. So for Zhu Fang to do this publicly, it screamed ultimate commitment, total break from Wu.
It's basically the perfect psychological weapon for that moment.
Yep.
It hits Cao Zhi right in his cultural understanding, bypasses all his strategic doubts. He buys it completely, throws a big banquet to celebrate.
See, he's totally convinced. But guess who shows up again just as the party's getting started?
Let me guess. Jia Ku, the voice of reason nobody wants to hear.
Exactly. Jia Ku arrives and tries one more time. He tells Cao Xiu flat out, the hair cutting is a trick. He even gives him that historical example, Yao Li cutting off his own arm just to get close enough to assassinate someone. He's trying to explain that self-harm can be a calculated political act of performance.
And Cao Xi's reaction this time, it's not just ignoring him, is it?
No, it's worse. Cao Xiu completely loses it. He's furious. Accuses Jia Ku of trying to destroy morale. He actually orders Jia Ku to be executed, though others plead for him and he's spared. But Cao Zhu strips him of his command, takes away his troops, that's it. Cao Zhu has totally locked himself into believing the lie. He's removed the last obstacle to his delusion. And Zhu Fang, he secretly gets a message to Lu Sun. Heaven is granting me success. The trap is primed.
And it doesn't take long to spring, does it? Cao Zhu marches his army right where Zhu Fang leads him, into this place called the Stone Pavilion Shiding, which sounds strategically narrow. Close.
Precisely. And then, surprise, surprise, Zhu Fang disappears, vanishes. That's when the penny drops for Cao Zhu. He realizes he's been had, but it's way too late.
Okay, so the battle starts. How does it unfold?
It's quick and brutal. Cao Zhu sends his vanguard under Zhang Pu forward. They run right into Wu forces led by Zhu Sheng and get routed almost immediately. Then Lu Xin triggers the main ambush. He's got Zhu Huan and Quan Kong ready with 30,000 troops each. They hit the rear flanks of Cao Zhu's camp, signaling with fire. Lu Xun himself pushes up the middle. Cao Zhu is caught.
Completely trapped.
Yeah.
And the Wei army just falls apart.
Utter chaos. Zhu Huan's forces slam into a reserve force led by Zhang Pu, the same vanguard commander, and Zhu Quan actually kills Zhang Pu in the fighting. Quan Kong defeats another reserve commander, Xu Kiao. The Wei army just disintegrates. They're fleeing down this narrow mountain road, Jianxi Road. It's a panic stampede, losing weapons, armor, everything. Just a total disaster.
A complete rout. Cao Zhu himself is fleeing for his life. And then the twist.
The twist. Cao Zhu, running desperately, gets intercepted. He thinks it's the end, but who is it? It's Jia Ku. The very general he humiliated threatened to execute and stripped of command.
Wow, that must have been an awkward reunion. What happens is Jiakui say, "I told you so."
Amazingly, no. Jiakui shows incredible professionalism. He sees the disaster, tells Kaoshi to just get out, hurry through the narrow pass before Wu blocks it completely. And then Jiakui does something really clever to save what's left of the army.
What does he do? He doesn't have many troops left, right?
Right, he has hardly any. But he uses them brilliantly. He spreads his banners and flags out wide in the dense woods along the dangerous paths. He makes his small force look like a much larger hidden army waiting in ambush, an optical illusion.
Ah, playing on the enemy's caution, creating doubt.
Exactly. Xu Sheng, leading the Wu pursuit, sees all these banners popping up in tricky terrain. He pauses. He gets worried he's about to run into another ambush, a fresh Wei force. That hesitation is all it takes. Xu Sheng stops the pursuit. Jiakou's bluff works.
And that saves Kaoshu and the remnants of his army. Incredible. Saved by the man he scorned.
A perfect example of quick tactical thinking. And when Sima Yi hears about this catastrophe in the east, he wisely pulls his own forces back too, avoids getting caught himself.
So the aftermath for Wu is pretty good.
Very good. Huge spoils. We're talking wagons, oxen, tools, weapons, plus tens of thousands of surrendered Wei soldiers. Sun Quan personally honors Lucian, holding the imperial canopy over him. Big celebrations. And Zhu Fang gets his reward too, made Marquis of Guanai. His great deception, his hair-cutting sacrifice, is literally recorded on bamboo and silk for posterity.
And strategically, Wu doesn't waste any time.
Right.
They immediately see the bigger picture.
Right away. Lucian advises Sun Quan, Wei is demoralized, their forces are scattered and recovering from this eastern disaster. Now's the time. Send an envoy to Xu, tell Zhu Xiliang to launch his invasion now, while Wei is weak and distracted.
Which connects everything back, as the sources put it. Because the Eastern Kingdom, Wu could apply strategy, the Western River, Xu, was again motivated to move troops. Success on one front created the opportunity on the other.